Welcome back to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Joanne Lippman's new book, That's What She Said, What Men Need to Know and Women Need to Tell Them About Working Together, could not be timelier. In it, she dissects the culture of the workplace with its ingrained gender bias and recommends how men and women can both recognize that bias and act to change it. The book is published by William Morrow. Joanne Lippman, welcome to Midday.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. So was this book inspired by an article you did for the Wall Street Journal titled Women at Work, A Guide for Men?
Yes, that's right.
That was from 2014.
Yes.
Like lifetimes ago.
A lot of people have asked me, did you write this really quickly since Me Too started? But no, actually, I've been working on it for 3 years. And the reason I started the book in the first place is because there's so many issues that women face at work, of which, by the way, sexual harassment and sexual predatory behavior is the extreme. But that stuff is enabled by a culture that includes things that every woman is familiar with, right? Every woman knows what it feels like to be marginalized at work, to not be heard, to not be respected, to be interrupted. And we talk about these issues all the time amongst ourselves, but we don't talk to men. And so I wrote that piece intentionally for a male audience because I felt like women talking to each other is half a conversation.
Yeah.
And you're going to get, at best, half a solution.
Well, so then in 2014, was there a catalytic event or you just had this idea, let's take this conversation out of our own little club here and bust it out?
That's exactly right. It was my own feeling. And it grew out of, I think, my own history. I spent my first 22 years of my career at the Wall Street Journal, where when I started, it was mostly men. But also, we were writing primarily about men. Our audience was primarily male. My mentors were all male, and they were phenomenal. I can't say enough about how great they were. And yet, here we were, women, just talking amongst ourselves. And the catalytic moment came. I was going to speak at a women's leadership conference in Des Moines, and I'm sitting next to this lovely man on the plane who's telling me about his kids and his business and his new house. And then he asked me, why are you going to Des Moines? And I said, to speak at a women's leadership conference. And he freezes up, and he says, sorry, I'm a man. And he launches in about the horrible diversity training that he had and how they just beat him up for 2 days and how he felt like the message was, it's all your fault. And the next day, speaking to this group of women, we're talking about these issues and I see, you know, 100 heads nodding in recognition of all these things, 100 female heads. And I just stopped in the middle and I said, you know what? We all know this. We need men in the room to discuss this, to hear this as well.
So when you wrote the piece, Women at Work, A Guide for Men, in the Wall Street Journal in 2014, did you hear mostly from men or from women? And was there a difference in the reaction between the two?
So yes, I heard from both. And what was really interesting, I heard, the piece went viral. I heard from both men and women. As you would expect, there were some men who criticized, who said, hey, lady, get with the program. This is a man's world and you need to deal with it and adjust to it. But I also heard from plenty of men. And interestingly enough, like men who said, you know what, I really related to your piece because I'm an introvert. And introverted men face a lot of the same issues that you're talking about that women face, also being overlooked and not heard and not promoted. And so it was very interesting. And then a lot of men who reached out because there are so many good guys out there who really would be allies of women who want to do the right thing. And they're searching for, you know, to understand their female colleagues. And for That's What She Said, for the book, I actually crisscrossed the country and the globe and spent time with mostly male executives at places like Google, Facebook, consumer products companies like Kimberly-Clark, to really talk to them about steps that they are taking proactively to close the gap.
Okay. I want to ask you about a situation that happened. This is when you were at the Journal.
Uh-huh.
And you mentioned before how the sexual harassment and the Me Too things are the extreme. But you did have a situation where you were interviewing a businessman in his hotel room. What did he do when you arrived?
Okay, so this is actually not in his hotel room, but what happened was I was a very young reporter, one of my first assignments. I was 22. And so this is a long time ago in a world far away where I went in to interview this man who was a business owner, and he closes his office door. It was his office. Closes the door, locks the door, strips to his underwear. And I was very rattled. At that time, this is pre-Anita Hill.
Oh, this is in the 80s.
So Anita Hill put her sexual harassment on the map.
The language.
The language. I'm not even sure I'd ever heard the phrase. And if I had heard the phrase, it would only to me and to my peers have meant essentially physical assault, right? We didn't really have that nomenclature at that time. And so my feeling was, okay, I got to stand my ground, and I don't want to let him rattle me. And so I took out my reporter's pad, and I interviewed him in his underwear. And then I went back to my office, and I told my editor of this piece what happened. And my editor's response was to laugh. He thought it was hilarious. And his point was, you know, you go, you young woman, you're earning your stripes in a man's world.
I mean, as a fellow journalist, I can understand why, even though he stripped down to his underwear, you took out your reporter's notebook, you took out your pen, and you did your job.
Right.
You did the interview. But let's talk about this. What on earth possesses someone to feel that they have the ability or the right to do that?
Right.
And is it the culture of the particular place where this interview is being done, or the mindset of the man who does it?
I think, as with everything that we've been hearing about with the sexual harassment and sexual predatory behavior, it's power. It's a power play. And in that case, I felt like the guy was trying to rattle me. And I do want to say that the reason I wrote about that story was because, fast forward to now, and no editor would laugh if that happened to a young reporter. And I think that is a major sign of progress, that we know that behavior is not acceptable. But it also is an issue of power. And I have to tell you, while we're talking about this, I have been completely flummoxed by the men who are exposing themselves and walking around in bathrobes. Like, I don't get that.
Yeah.
Right? I don't understand that at all.
Oh, I mean, again, I mean, maybe it goes to the power thing, but okay, so I'm a guy.
But we've established that.
Yes, but it would never in a million years to occur to me to do anything like that, especially in the office in a professional setting with a reporter there. He must have felt reasonably comfortable that would not end up in the story.
And it did end up in the story. We actually put it into the story in the end. But the point at that point really was, it was a different time, and I think I was very young, and I think he
afraid,
was trying.
I forgot to ask, were you afraid when that happened?
Yes, at the
rattled,
moment.
But
at the moment, I was terrified. But my thought process was, as long as he doesn't touch me, I will be okay. And that's why I'm saying that the definitionally, we were at a very different point where I wasn't, harassment to me was a physical assault.
Right.
Right. And so, but when I left, I was fine. I was not traumatized. But the interesting thing, because there's a generational difference in how people are perceiving some of the issues that we even see today, where when I wrote about that, a number of younger readers and reporters approached me and said, oh my gosh, did you get counseling? Were you traumatized? You know, and actually, no, I wasn't. My boss was proud of me. He thought it was awesome. And then an older reporter who's covered, you know, every president since Reagan, at least, came up to me, a woman, and her response was, that was hilarious. Like, who among us hasn't had that kind of experience as we came up the ranks? And so there is a generational difference in perception.
You know, in speaking with friends of mine, women, professional women, the conversation about the generational divide has come up, and how older women, for them, and I'm generalizing here to get the point out, that it was all about, we're the first to crack the ceiling in whichever industry that we're in. And so these things happen. We look out for each other, but we got to be one of the guys in order to be accepted. And then younger professional women are like they've benefited from that camaraderie, and now to your point where women are coming to you saying, have you received counseling? That's a big culture shift. But that doesn't mean that the behavior that's generating these two types of reactions hasn't changed.
Right. So I think what's really interesting in what you're saying here is, and what is a little bit dispiriting, I have to say, is the fact that this kind of behavior is still happening. And so much of the response, you know, that's what she said, just came out. And I'm getting all kinds of emails from people who said, I read it in one sitting. I stayed up all night to read it. And young women, this is young women who I am hearing from, who are saying this, you know, this is so relevant today. And I think that, you know, it's frustrating because I think that when I came into the workforce, our assumption was all of these problems would be solved by now. And in fact, if you look at, and this is one of the things I talk about in That's What She Said, I look at, you know, it's kind of these institutional biases, but also unconscious bias that has held back women in a way that I think a lot of us weren't aware of and are just becoming aware of, these little biases we have that prevent women from advancing further.
Well, let's talk about that further. I was going to get into that a little bit later, but let's talk about unconscious bias. Name a few.
Sure. So this is something, by the way, that does not start in the workplace. It starts way, 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 way earlier. And all of us have these biases. I took the implicit bias test, which you can take online, and I took the one for working women, and even I came out as moderately biased against working women.
Huh.
And what it means is it manifests itself in multiple ways, but starting young. So, for example, mothers of babies routinely overestimate how quickly their baby sons begin to crawl, and they underestimate how quickly their baby daughters begin to crawl. Then if you go up to two-year-olds, parents of two-year-olds who ask Google, is my child a genius, are more than twice as likely to ask that about a two-year-old boy than a two-year-old girl. In first grade, really interesting experiment done on first graders. They were given a math test, and the names were taken off the papers, and they were graded by first grade teachers. The girls outscored the boys. Same thing, then they were regraded with names on them. This time the boys outscored the girls.
How's that possible if we're talking about math?
Math, right? You would think that it's black and white.
Right.
Right? But as it turns out, that the teachers had this unconscious bias where they were given a little bit of extra credit, a little bit of, you know, they were given a pass a little bit to the boys, and they were going harder on the girls.
Okay.
So by the time
by
the time you get up to college, because this continues all the way up, by the time you get to college, a girl has to have an A average to be seen as the equivalent of a boy with a B average. And even though girls, women, are now more than half of college students, they speak less than the male students in class, and they are called on less frequently by professors than the boys in the class.
Now, you write in the book that boys are taught from an early age not to listen to girls. How are they taught that?
So it's not so much that I tell my son, don't listen to girls. It is the way that children learn how to play together. Girls learn how to play by playing cooperatively and you know, with one another. Boys learn how to play by competing, and there's a winner and a loser. And you fast forward to adulthood, and that's how men and women both act in the workplace. And that leads to a lot of miscommunication. And it's really the reason behind That's What She Said is to actually, you know, to tell men, really, here are some of the issues so that we can understand the differences in how we communicate so that we can actually understand each other better.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I've been sitting here wondering, what do you think, or why do you think women haven't talked about these issues with men?
Well, okay, so this is really interesting. So part of it is that men have been afraid to engage. So Catalyst, which is a nonprofit that looks at working women, it actually surveyed men, and it said to them, what might prevent you from being a champion for equality in the workplace? And 51% of the men actually said lack of awareness of exactly what those issues are. 74% of the men cited fear, and part of the fear is fear of loss of status and fear of embarrassment among other men. but also fear of saying the wrong thing. And I think any woman would say that when you're in mixed company and the issue of gender or any of these issues comes up, the men just clam up and they're afraid to say the wrong thing. With that, so she said, I am hoping to eliminate the fear, to make this discussable in mixed company.
Well, it's just like that guy who was sitting next to you on the plane when you were going to Iowa for that women's leadership conference who you said that and he froze up.
Right. And I've actually gotten, you know, I've done a number of television appearances talking about this, and I will get notes from viewers saying, you know, do you realize that when you started talking about this, that the guy sitting next to you suddenly got this stricken look on his face? And I hadn't noticed it, but it's something that I really want to eliminate because we're never going to solve this issue unless men and women come together and can do this without fear and without any of the political connotations or any of that loaded kind of feeling around it, right?
Okay, so if you were to see the man on the plane again, or that anchor who looked stricken, or a man who might be complaining about the fact, oh, it's so difficult to be a man right now, I feel under attack, I don't know what to say. What would you say to those men now?
Sure.
To either allay their fears or to say, relax, fella.
Yes. Well, I would actually say relax. And I would say, hey, let's talk about it. Let's, you know, what are the issues? And by the way, the man who said that talked about diversity training was not wrong in that diversity training, there's been a study of 30 years of diversity training at over 700 companies by a Harvard professor. And he concluded that it actually didn't work and, in fact, backfired for women as well as for African Americans. That part of it, there were a number of reasons. One of the reasons was that the men who took it sort of, you know, felt like they washed their hands. Okay, I'm done. But another reason was just resentment, that the men felt like they were being beaten up on. And I talked to a veteran diversity trainer who said, look, when we started this kind of training 30 years ago, it's true. We wanted to beat men over the head with a 2x4. And we have since realized the error of our ways. Like, that's not the way to do this.
And after the break, we'll talk more about diversity training. But is the model now, instead of beating them over the head, clubbing them over the head, is it let's have a conversation, let's hear what you have to say and work together to get to a place where at least you have an understanding of what the issue is or issues are?
Well, that's the model that I would like to see. And that's what she said is all about, is to open up that conversation, definitely.
All right. I want to take the break now because there's a whole lot to get to, diversity training and men feeling beaten up. And then I want to talk to you about one of the things where guys, you hear them complaining about, well, how do I talk about appearance?
Yes.
Of a woman. We'll talk about it when we come back. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Joanne Lipman about her new book, That's What She Said, What Men Need to Know and Women Need to Tell Them About Working Together. We'll be right back after a break. This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Joanne Lipman about her new book, That's What She Said, What Men Need to Know and Women Need to Tell Them About Working Together. Before we went to break, we were talking about diversity training and men feeling beaten up and some of the things, some guys say, I don't know what I can say anymore. And one area where I'm sure a lot of men feel really uncomfortable is, what can I tell my coworker that about her appearance, like compliment her appearance and not be perceived as, I don't know, my old fashioned language, being a masher. I don't know.
Yes, you can. So here's the deal. We're seeing a lot of men who are freezing up in their normal office relationships. That's the last thing that women want. So first of all, guys should know that the vast majority of women are not looking at their male colleagues as potential sexual predators, right? And also, the vast majority of men are absolutely fine. What we are seeing is people start to question their own behavior. And what I would say to that is, if you have a concern, just ask. So for example, just the other night, I met for a drink with a business friend, a guy, and we met at a restaurant and he gave me a hug and he suddenly pulls away and he says, uh-oh, is that still okay? And I laughed and I said, of course, it's okay. We've known each other for 10 years. Of course, it's fine. But I also appreciated that he asked the question. And because it shows a level of respect. And by the way, he will never have to ask that question again. He knows it's okay. So I think, you know, I saw this as well. I was in Davos at the World Economic Forum last week. And a number of the women, there's very few women at Davos, but the few women that were there, who I spoke to, all were talking about the same thing, that even like in a group photo, like guys were like hesitant before putting their arms around you. And to that, I just say, just ask. But also, most guys are they're not creepy and they're not criminal. And if you're a creepy guy, you probably know it. And most guys, right. So really just relax.
So I bring up appearance because appearance does matter in work and in life. And you talk about women changing their appearance to fit in the workplace. Talk about that.
Yes. So it's amazing the changes that women, the adjustments that women make 100 times a day, maybe more, are absolutely invisible to men. And some of them have to do with appearance. So for example, women who are taller, make 8% more than women who are shorter, which is one reason, I guess, why I've worn high heels my whole life.
Huh.
Women who are in power are disproportionately blonde. 5% of the Caucasian population in the United States is blonde. Almost half of female CEOs and congresswomen are blonde. And the theory is that as women gain power, it becomes more threatening and more sort of out of the norm. And so to try and diminish themselves and not seem threatening, these women, the blonde hair is more youthful and considered less threatening. Women spend, there was a wonderful stat from Deborah Spar, who used to be the president of a college.
I was going to say, just name the industry.
No, it wasn't Columbia. It was
a big university.
Yes. So anyway, she wrote a wonderful, wonderful book about this, and she calculated that the amount of time she spends getting ready versus that of her husband is the equivalent of 5 years over the course of a woman's career. And all of these things, you know, while men are out there getting ahead of the game, women have all these other adjustments that we make that are just invisible to men. We also adjust the way we speak. Women are much more likely to use hedging language like sorry and I hope you don't mind. Women are much more likely to use upspeak.
Yes, I was about to say up talking. Yes.
And so part of this is that, you know, women are adjusting to a man's world every day. And what is encouraging to me is we see a lot more men who are saying, okay, I've got to adjust to women as well. And so like a quickie, for instance, would be, we know that we've all been there. There's the car and the man and the woman, and the woman says, shouldn't we be turning right instead of left? And what she actually means is, we're going the wrong way. Men now are, got to learn how to kind of hear it, interpret it differently, right? So that they don't just mansplain the answer.
That's one of the greatest words of all time. I love mansplaining. It says so much. In terms of women changing their appearance, I'm sitting here thinking about men. I mean, they adjust their appearance as well. Power suits and the gigantic watches and things. Correct me if I'm wrong, for women, it's about maybe fitting in, again, generalizing here. And for men, it's about exerting power. Am I thinking about that in the right way in terms of the way they handled their appearance?
Well, certainly in terms of women, right? Women, all the adjustments that we're making every single day really are literally to fit into a world that was created by and for men. I mean, the modern office was actually created after World War II. It was a military model. It was made for men. One example, leftover example, office temperatures were set by a thermostat that is based on a 150-pound man. And men have a much faster metabolism than women do, which is why women are always freezing in the office. And I used to think it's just me. Then I realized every other woman is freezing. Well, it's there's a reason for that.
And also, I seem to recall that a lot of the medications and the testing were all done on men and...
Yes, because men are less complicated physiologically. And so as a result, there's been some pretty dangerous things. So Ambien actually had to cut its recommended dosage in half because women were being way overprescribed Ambien because it had been tested on men. Seatbelts were tested on men. And that became also women were much more likely to get injured in a car crash because of the way seatbelts hit their anatomy.
Okay, I got to bring you back to appearance because something called a mercy mission when you were at Condé Nast, which reminded me of that great scene in A Devil Wears Prada where the office assistant is brought in to the vault by Stanley Tucci to up her game when it came to her wardrobe. What was your mercy mission?
So as I said, I started at the Wall Street Journal where I worked for 22 years, and then I went and became an editor-in-chief at Condé Nast, running a business magazine. And one day, the art department, which was the photo department, actually, it was, I come in and I was sort of, you know, bombarded by these women who had brought in a makeup artist because they said that my makeup application was, as they said, too New Jersey.
Oh.
How I was born and raised in New Jersey, so I do not take that as fine with me, right?
Right.
It's not an insult to me. But their point was that the world that you are in judges you on your appearance, and you need to have a certain look in order to fit into that world.
Okay, I want to get into, we've talked about diversity training and how that needs to change and is changing from the 2x4 over the head to something a little more holistic. But there's also a need, in terms of diversity, there needs to be a diversity in, so like in job interviews.
Yes.
Not, people are always worried about diversity in the applicants, but there should be diversity in the interviewer.
Right. This is one of the pieces of research that, and as I said, I interviewed a lot of successful men who are trying to reach across the gap. And this is one of the things that I learned from these men that actually changed the way I manage myself, which is I knew that you should always have a diverse slate of candidates, you know, race, ethnicity, gender. But what these men said is, you know what, that's not enough, because if you have a bunch of white guys doing all the interviews, you will still not get the optimal result because you get the groupthink. You get that coded language as in, oh, they're not a cultural fit, right? Which is very often just means they're different than us. And so, but when you have that diverse slate of interviewers, you get a much better result.
All right. So in the time that we have left, we have to talk about this thing that we've been talking about in the break. And that is throughout this conversation, this interview, as you're talking about this, that's what she said. We're talking about the relationship, the interaction between men and women. But to me, as an African-American and as a gay man, I'm hearing things that ring true to me through both those identities. And I'm wondering, through your research in this book, how do those two things come into play in what you're writing here?
100% they come into play. So first of all, a lot of the research that I cite, and then a lot of the people I spoke to, the research, a lot of it has actually been done looking at different groups. And when we're looking at unconscious bias, we're looking at, it looks at LGBT and at African-Americans, actually looks at obese people, elderly people. So much of what we're talking about is applicable. For women in particular, that women often face a double bind. African-American women, Hispanic women face much higher rates of discrimination, and they face much larger wage gaps. So they've got it coming, you know, from multiple directions. I also, when I've written and spoken about these issues, I very frequently do hear from introverted men as well. So these issues are not, it's not just women, it's whatever the out group, as they say in sociology, is, right? The in group is the group that has the power, which is generally white men. Those who fall outside of that generally are penalized for it.
Is it possible for someone in the out group or out groups to break through just on the sheer power of their own personality and their own drive? Or does it depend on having someone who's on the other side of that, either a person you're interviewing with or say you're going in and asking for a raise, having that person take you seriously.
Right. So that's the whole point of That's What She Said, is to say, okay, how do we solve this? And it does take both sides. I mean, clearly people can break through. Look at you. You're like hosting a radio and I've got a book. So, right. So
it's that simple. Right.
But no, seriously, the it takes a concerted effort and it takes awareness on the part of everyone to be part of this conversation. And it cannot happen of just, one side or the other. So from the perspective of managers, there are tips in That's What She Said that are specific to managers, that things they can do, like along hiring. One of the things we talk about also is just older women who are completely invisible and have a very hard time getting hired or rehired if they've taken time off. And then there are things that any one of us can do. So, for example, women are interrupted 3 times more frequently than men. And if you're a boss, like I talked to Glenn Mazzara, who was the producer of The Shield and The Walking Dead, and he created a rule in the writer's room because he found female writers were not getting their ideas across. And he realized it was because they were getting interrupted. So he just created no interruptions. Whoever's speaking cannot be interrupted, right? And there's other things that any one of us can do also. Women, if you're less than a third of a room, very often your voice is not heard. So every woman is familiar with that. She has an idea, she says something, crickets. Nobody seems to hear it. Some guy repeats it, 2 minutes later, and suddenly Bob is a genius. Bob had a great idea, and he gets the credit, and the idea has legs. And any person in that room should feel enabled to call out and say, hey, Olivia had that idea first, and why doesn't she elaborate on that?
Enabled. The word that came to my mind was empowered.
Empowered, yes.
So I had this question, and a caller also had this question. You've mentioned a couple of times unconscious bias. Before, you mentioned that there was an implicit bias test that you took. Do you remember where you took that test?
Yes, you can go online. I believe the site is projectimplicit.org. Yes.
And so you can take this test. I think I did one. It wasn't implicit bias. Maybe it was just, or maybe it's the same one about racial bias, and I came out okay. Empowering people to say something. I'm also thinking that in the end, we're trying to get to a point where there is mutual respect.
Yes.
And that we're at a time when there's not enough of it, but at the same time, it seems like people are so aware that there's not enough of it that they're trying their best in their ways to show mutual respect. Am I right? Wrong?
100%. And the bottom line for so many of the issues between men and women is respect. And I have an entire chapter on respect, and there's a respect gap between men and women, and it manifests itself in multiple ways. Just for instance, I actually focused a lot on physicians in that chapter. So female physicians are far more likely to be introduced by their first name, while males are introduced with the honorific doctor, right? Female physicians are often mistaken for nurses. Nurses are incredibly important, but the reason that the mistake is made is because people have a hard time understanding that a woman would be a surgeon.
This has been such a great conversation. I wish we had more time. I've been speaking with Joanne Lipman about her new book, That's What She Said, What Men Need to Know and Women Need to Tell Them About Working Together. Tonight at 7, Joanne Lipman will be in conversation with Cindy Levy, former editor-in-chief of Glamour at the Upper West Side Barnes & Noble. For more information, visit our show page at WNYC.org. That's where you will also find a link to that implicit bias test that Joanne was talking about. Joanne, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.